time and thought and go around. Because when I first started talking over 11 years ago about Linux and creating open source software, my boss said to me, "Mad Dog, who in the world would ever come to hear you talk about free software?" And so I started taking pictures of the audience to show them. And of course, the first couple of pictures were rather disappointing because there were only 4 or 5 people in the room. But over time, it increased. My talk today is called Service, the Promise of Free and Open Source Software. And I used the title of the movie, Back to the Future, to illustrate this. Because in reality, we're going to return to the way the software was originally made, not what has happened since 1980. I'll explain that in the future. First of all, my lawyers tell me that I have to remind everybody that Linux is a trademark of Linus Torvalds in many countries around the world. Linus would like everybody to use the word Linux for any appropriate purpose, but we have to protect the trademark. Unix is a trademark of XOpen, and XOpen uses that to brand various operating systems as being Unix compatible. And therefore, you can have any operating system written with any source code base as long as it supports the APIs that XOpen specifies. Linus actually tells Go that they're wrong. And finally, non-service is a trademark of proprietary software, and I'm going to show you that in this talk. Now, for those of you who do not know me, who don't know me well, a lot of you think that I'm a technical marketing person or a marketing person or just a nice guy with a white beard. But in reality, I've been in computer science a long time. I started commercially programming in 1969 with systems that had 4 kilobytes of main memory and a 0.5 megabyte disk drive. The difference between that and some of the microcomputers that you're aware of today is that this machine weighed over 2 tons and cost over $2 million. In 1969, that was a lot of money. I started using Unix in 1980, and I started using Linux in May of 1994 when I met Linus Torvalds for the first time. I've had many different jobs. I've been a programmer. I've been a system architect, a designer, a QA manager. I have been a systems administrator. I have been an educator at the university level. I've taught operating system design and compiler theory. I've been a technical marketing manager, product manager. I've worked for very large companies and very small companies. But most importantly, I've been on both sides of the fence. I've been both a producer of software and a consumer of software. And so I know how the consumer feels when they feel trapped with software that doesn't work or doesn't meet their needs. And who are you? I've been told that today is more of a technical audience than yesterday. So I assume that most of you are programmers or systems administrators or people that do with the production of software in some way, shape, or form. You're also a software entrepreneur tomorrow. Today you may be a programmer or an engineer, but tomorrow you're going to have to be more than that. You're going to have to be the person who actually delivers a software answer or solution to the customer, not something that some product manager has given to you and said, this is what the customer needs. But in reality, the solution that the customer wants, that's what you're going to have to deliver. And so you're going to have to deliver and generate more talents than you have today. You're going to have to be the engineer and the architect, and in a lot of ways, the technical salesperson, the person who goes in and analyzes the customer's problems and delivers a solution. Now, a lot of people say to me, Mad Dog, you can't make money selling free software. In fact, in a couple of days, I'm supposed to go to a major university in Germany and speak with one of the leading open source free software professors there, and convince him that yes, you actually can make money with free software. And the problem is that most people, when they hear the word free software, they immediately think of the word grass, without cost. As W.C. Fields, comic in the United States, once said, there's no such thing as free lunch. You pay for it in one way or the other. And in the case of free software, the freedom we talk about is the freedom to be able to change the source code and have it meet your needs. And the only freedom that you should not have with free software is the freedom to limit another person's freedom. You should not have the ability to take away the freedom of somebody else, the freedom that you have enjoyed in changing the software to meet your needs. You're paying for service, not for the software itself. And therefore, once you have done that service one time, you should not have the ability to limit the way that the person applies that software to whatever they want to do. Now, a lot of people look at free software and they look at Richard Stallman, maybe as the way his physical appearance or something. Maybe he looks a lot like the leader of a small island country off the coast of Florida that the United States has not had very many good feelings about for the last 40 years. But they relate him with communism. And he is not a communist. I have never, in the 20 years I've been with Richard Stallman, heard him one time say that you should not be able to charge for your time and your energy as a programmer. But what he does say is that after you have delivered the software, it should be free. And the freedom he's talking about, of course, is the freedom. So I like to think of it as cooperativism. The fact that everybody is cooperating with each other to generate a solution. And in the end, what people pay for is the service of having that delivered to them so they can use it. Now yesterday, when I gave a talk to a more general audience, I had to remind them that open source is not a new concept. In the period between 1943 and 1980, almost all software was in effect open source. When you wanted to have a piece of software written, you went out and you formed a contract with somebody to write the software for you. Whether that was with an external company that was going to write the software, or whether that was with an internal group inside your company that was going to write the software. And you said to them, here are the inputs that I have, and here are the outputs that I expect, and here are the steps which I think you need to take along the way to solve the problem, and you turn that into code, so I can do it many hundreds of times or thousands of times very quickly. And you formed a contract with that group, and you said, okay, if the software doesn't work when you get finished, I don't pay you for it. If the software is late, I don't pay you for it. If the software is buggy, I don't pay you for it. If you don't have proper documentation for it, I don't pay you for it. And I think this is a very refreshing type of feeling. Because today, when you buy a piece of software, sometimes you put it on your computer and it doesn't even work. And you try and get the money back for it, and the store tells you, well, I'm sorry, you broke the shrink wrap. And you can't return it. And you say, well, what about the warranty? And they said, oh, the warranty says it's not good for any particular purpose. It's not even guaranteed to install. And says, well, how do I find that out? We have to break the shrink wrap to find that out. Catch-22. But in the old days, this didn't happen. And I do remember many times negotiating these contracts with the customer, or when I was a customer, negotiating a contract with the vendor to supply that software. In fact, if it was a very large project, you actually negotiated the project two times. The first time, you negotiated a contract to study the problem and to come up with a suggested solution. And then, you negotiate the contract to implement the solution. And that was the way that people solved problems. Well, in the period between 1980 and 1990, the cost of computer systems was dropping rapidly. Microcomputers had come into being. People said, we can stand these computers out now like cookie cutters. the software is still incredibly expensive. Maybe we can manufacture software the same way we manufacture hardware. And we can find out what the average person wants and develop software which will meet their needs. Not all of their needs, but maybe 70 or 80 or 90% of their needs. And so what they will then do is change the way they do business, meet the way the software works. And it worked for a while. I remember buying software back in the 1980s, and I would have a problem with it, I would call up the company, and I would get the president of the company on the line, and I would tell him my problem, and he would say, okay, we can fix that tonight, because he was also the chief programmer. And we will QA it tomorrow afternoon because he's also the head of QA. And we'll ship it out the next day because he's also the head shipping clerk. And I would have it 2 days after that. And he could say that because I was one of only 1,000 customers which he had. And he needed to keep me happy. Now, 20 years later, if I called with the same company, I wouldn't get the president of the company on the line, nor the chief programmer, nor the head of QA, nor the head shipping clerk, nor a junior programmer, nor the lowest person in QA. What I would get is, please press button number 1 for sales, button number 2 for service. And then I would get USAC on the line, and then I would get disconnected. Mass production of software has failed because it doesn't scale. Now, what do people really want out of life? I feel that what people really want is service. A lot of us go around driving cars and things like that and get from one place to the other. But in the 24th and 27th centuries, Star Trek showed us what they really wanted was a way to get from one place to the other. And if I could say, beat me up, Scotty, and beat me down in San Juan, Puerto Rico, which is nice and warm and a woman and beautiful color, then I would do that. If I could say, I want to have Earl Grey hot, and the replicator would produce that piece of tea for me, that would be what I would want. Because I don't want to have to cook. I don't want to have to go to the store and get the food. That's not fun for me. I want my food nice and hot in front of me when I want it. I want service. Well, what do they get? They don't get service. What they get is music. Okay? And that's a problem. But there is an example of a company that does not make computer products and make service. This company is called EDS. They have never made any products. They make service. And EDS goes in and looks at a customer's problem and says, we will hire the programmers, we will hire the operators, we will buy the computer equipment for you, we will buy the supplies, we will do everything, Mr. Business Person, that you need to do, and all you have to do is write us a check. And this, believe it or not, is what a lot of people want, because you know a little secret. Most people hate computers. They really do. We're all strange. Some of us actually hate computers. They hate. Now, a lot of people in proprietary software companies will say, Mando, service just does not scale. I can't produce service the way I can stamp out CDs and floppy disks. And they're right. Service is a very difficult thing to do because you have to find really well-trained people and you have to pay them a very good salary. And you have to give them interesting work to keep them with your company. And you have to have good management skills in order to be able to escalate them and train them and take them along the their career path. What they're talking about when they say it's difficult, when they say it doesn't scare them, they are saying it's difficult for them to do that. Versus stamping out a floppy disk and selling it for 80% margin markup. 80% profitability on the floppy disk. A friend of mine one time went to Redmond, Washington in the early days of Microsoft. He came back from Redmond and said, "Mad Dog, they're printing money in Redmond." He says they take a black plastic disk instead of a piece of paper, and they put computer bits on it instead of a piece of ink. But it's the same thing. They're printing money. And it is. And they charge you a phenomenal amount of money. There is a reason why Bill Gates is the richest man in the world. Paul Allen is the third richest man in the world. Steve Ballmer is the 12th richest man in the world. And Microsoft has probably generated more millionaires than any other company. But the question you have to ask yourself is it better as a world economy that we have one 80 billionaire? Or is it better that we have 80,000 millionaires? I think the latter is a better situation. Customers experience the opposite side. Customers find out that proprietary software does not scale. That proprietary software doesn't meet all of their needs. That proprietary software, they can't get their fixes that they need, and they can't get the enhancements that they need. Now, I told you that at one time I was a product manager. And for 5 years, I was a product manager of Digital Unix. Digital's Unix operating system. And when I first became the product manager of that, I said, we're going to do this in a very systematic way. I am going to go out to all my customers and find out what their needs are. And we're going to make a list of those needs. And we're going to sort them from the most important need to the least important. And we came up with a list of 650 different needs that customers told us what they needed. And I went to my team of 500 engineers, and I said, how many of these can you do in the year that we have the release cycle? And they looked at it, and they studied it, and they said, we can do the top 50, and then maybe one or two of the ones down below. And I said, what about the other 600? And they said, we'll do that in the next release. And if you believe that, I have a bridge to sell you in New York City. Because, of course, in the next release, there were more standards to support. There were more hardware to support. There were more customer needs that were communicated to us. And the need that you had, that was number 300 in the list, went down instead of up. And the bug fix that you needed desperately because your project was being stopped went further down the list instead of up. It's not because we didn't want to solve the problems. It's not because we didn't want to have a good product. We did. It's just we could not do it. It was impossible. And people say to me, oh, Mad Dog, why don't you just hire more engineers? Well, there's a man named Fred Brooks who wrote a book called The Mythical Man Month that says that doesn't work. You can't just keep adding engineers. And so we were stuck. We had no way out of it. A lot of times I'll talk with a room of 1,000 business people in the room. And I'll say, how many of you have ever had a problem with proprietary software? And of course, everybody will raise their hand, except one person who's And I say, how many of you have ever taken the time to write in a well-worded problem report on that? And now about 750 hands will stay raised because they're business people and they expect their software to work. And then I will say to them, how many of you who sent in that problem report have ever gotten back a well-worded workaround or bug fix for that? Now all the hands will go down, except for maybe about 100 of them out of 1,000. I'm not saying that you never give them back. You do. And particularly if your name is William Gates. But the percentage that you give back is relatively small. And also the question you've got to ask yourself is it in your time frame, the time frame that you need, or is it the time frame that the vendor is going to supply it to you? You do not have the ability to make a software business decision because you do not have the source code for that product. You are at the mercy of the vendor who gave you that software. If you have the source code, you can make a business decision about going out and finding somebody with the technical expertise to look at that source code and figure out whether or not they can fix it. Oracle recently, Computer Associates recently opened up the source code for their product called Inquis. In a year following that decision, 80% of the software bugs that were fixed in their product were actually given to them by their customers. 80%. And they were deliriously happy because there was no way they were going to fix all those problems if they had to do it with the engineering staff that they had. Because it was the customer who experienced the problem. It was the customer who could duplicate the problem. It was the customer who, in a lot of cases, had the expertise to look inside the database and find the problem. And they developed the solution, they tested it on their own system first, and gave it to the Inquis engineers to allow them to be able to implement it back into the Inquis code base. I asked one more question of my business people. How many of you have ever had to change the way you do business to meet the way the software works? And now, out of a team of 1,000 people, probably about 3/4 of them will raise their hand. And this is something simple as having to retrain all of your people because the next version of the product came out. It was completely different from the old version and had all these features that you didn't want. But oh, by the way, the company was dropping support for the old version, and so you needed to implement it. Oh, did I mention the fact that the new version doesn't work with the old version of the operating system, so you had to upgrade that too? Oh, did I forgot to tell you that the new operating system doesn't work with the old hardware, so you had to upgrade that too? You've been there. If you have the source code for it, you can make the business decision of whether or not you're going to fix that bug or go with the new version. But when you don't have the source code, that business decision is taken away from you. Now, why is all this apparent now? Why is this amplified now? A variety of different reasons. The drop in hardware prices is allowing people to use computers who've never used them before. Back in 1980, when proprietary software was starting up, computers were still relatively expensive. A computer system was, say, 32 kilobytes of main memory and a 1 megabyte disk, and maybe a couple floppy disks. It might cost you $12,000 at a time that you could buy a Toyota pickup truck for $5,000. And so consequently, the number of people using the computers and the people using the computers were relatively highly trained people. relatively few at each company. And so if the difference between what the software did and what the person needed was rather large, it didn't make any difference. The person adapted, and the money lost in efficiency between the gap was relatively small. But in today's world, with so many people using computers, if the efficiency, if you only lose $3 a day for each computer that you have because the software crashes or it doesn't do what you want it to, and you have 1,000 computers in your organization, that means you lose $3,000 a day because of inefficiencies in the software. Now let's not be Pollyanna about this. I don't expect that we can change the software to reduce the efficiency, or to increase the efficiency, to the point where we don't lose any money in inefficiency per day. But let's say we can make the software meet our needs, so we save $1 a day per system. That means we can save $1,000 a day. That means we can afford to hire somebody to make the software more efficient and pay them $1,000 a day. Now, how many of you would be willing to work for $1,000 a day? You, out there, you don't want to work for $1,000. You must be making a lot of money, okay? I would. I would gladly work for $1,000 a day. The amplification is coming also because we have different needs to be met. How many of you think that computers are every place? Oh, guys, get out of here. They're not. If you look at the statistics, there are only about 550 million general purpose computer systems in the world. Desktop systems, low-end mid-range servers. Only 550 million. And I have 10 of them in my house. That's because I'm a white Anglo-Saxon American pig. But if you go to Africa, or if you go to South America, or if you go to inner city Chicago, you find out that computers are not every place. And if you take a look and you realize that there are 6.3 billion people on the face of the planet, that means that 5.8 billion people have not selected their operating system yet. And while it's true that 40% of those people will die without ever having made a telephone call, their governments are trying to bring the internet and the web to these people to help them get information that they need. That means that they're going to be in languages different than we're used to. How many of you speak English as a first language? How many of you speak Danish as a first language? Oh my God! I'm surprised! Doesn't everybody speak English as a first language? Be amazed how long it took for my engineers in the United States to understand why we couldn't just use 7-bit ASCII. The other thing that's driving this is the fact that across the world, we don't have the same economic structure. The average Chinese person makes 60 US dollars a day outside of Beijing. And so in order for them to buy a copy of Microsoft Office, they have to work for 10 months in order to buy it. 10 months is not buying any other thing. No food, no clothing, no going out with beautiful women on dates. Or if it's a woman programmer, no going out with beautiful men on dates. I don't want to be sexist here. In other words, Microsoft Office for these people is the equivalent of 14,000 US dollars. And then they pay their money for this, and they get this shiny plastic disc. Now the Chinese people are not stupid. In fact, they're very well educated. And they look at this plastic disc that just paid $14,000 for, and they realize that they can get the same disc at their local CD store for only $2. I said that one time in a conference, and a voice in the back of the room said, $1! And I could see I was sitting at the top negotiating. But the funny thing is that if they pull the software off of the net and then locally make the changes to that software, a day's worth of programming in the local economy for a Chinese person has the same monetary value as a day's worth of programming in the Danish marketplace for programming. Has the same monetary value as a day's worth of programming in the U.S. price structure for local programming. In other words, while they can't afford the $40,000 for that disk, they can afford to spend a day's worth of programming time in making that software meet their needs. And this is one reason why the Chinese government has said, yes, we recognize that we have a lot of Microsoft software that is being pirated, but we know the way for us to go is with open source software. There was a man in the United States named Henry Ford who basically brought about the automobile production industry as we know it. Before Mr. Ford came along, all the cars were hand-built. They were built, and if you needed to make a part fit in the car, you changed the part to make it fit in the car. Consequently, when the car broke, 500 miles away from the manufacturing plant, in order to get it fixed, you either sent the car back to the plant, or you had an engineer from the plant come out to the car with the spare part and make it fit the car individually. Well, this was kind of bad because after a while, Detroit would have broken cars about 3 miles in depth. And they realized that something had to give, and along came Mr. Ford and said, I'm going to invent the concept of the assembly line. But in order for the assembly line to work, I'm going to have to invent standards. Standards for standard parts that fit in a standard place. And so these parts are now going to be interchangeable. And I can take any alternator of any car and fit it in my car. And this allowed the assembly line to happen. Because you couldn't have the assembly line stop while the person fit the part to the car. But it did a second thing. It allowed a new industry to emerge called the corner garage. Because now anybody who had the expertise of being able to fix the car could order the part from Henry Ford in Detroit and have it delivered to them. In fact, you could even stock the parts. You didn't have to wait for the delivery time because you knew that sooner or later somebody would need that alternator or that belt. And therefore, you created competition. And you would have one garage say, we will give you fast and friendly service, and we'll charge you for it. And then, more typically, you would have the cheap, slow, and bumpy service, which is what most people went for. But you had a choice. You no longer had to go back to the dealer who sold you the car or go back to the vendor. You could choose the service model you wanted. Another thing which affects this is something called balance of trade. Now in the United States we don't think about this too much because we have a lot of software we sell from, say, Redmond, Washington, and and Silicon Valley. And we get a lot of money flowing into the United States from all these different countries around the world. And so we think that this is great. But when you go to some other country, they say, hey, we kind of object to sending our money to the United States for the software, particularly when it doesn't work. And when you go to free software, and you accept the model of pulling the software down off of that and then changing it to meet the customer's needs, this means it generates local jobs in your own country. And those local jobs are had by people who buy local food, have local housing, and pay local taxes. Now, I'm pretty sure that people in Denmark pay taxes. We do, too. Except in my state of New Hampshire, where we have no sales tax and no income tax. We'll get more into that later. But in almost any state, in almost any country, you have to understand that when you send one kroner outside of Denmark, it's actually 10 kroners worth of money. You're taking away 10 kroners. Because that kroner never comes back. There's only so much cheese that Mr. Bill will eat. Okay. Now, the other side of this, people say to me, Mandel, why do you talk about this? Because you're an American. Don't you want to see all this money coming in the United States? But what people don't know is the United States is actually made up of 50 small countries. I live in the small country of New Hampshire. Mr. Gates lives in the small country of Redmond, Washington. And I have a lot of unemployed programmers in New Hampshire that I would like to see employed. Because otherwise they stand on the street corner and drink beer. And every time I send a dollar to Mr. Bill in his country, that means it's one less dollar that I can spend on my programmers in New Hampshire. And so I want to see local programming that buys local food, local housing, and pays local taxes. One other thing in an international market we have to think about is things like culture and language. A little while ago, I asked how many of you spoke Danish as a first language. You know, it's still relatively easy because Danish is a language spoken by enough people that usually you can get an operating system or a word processor to support it. But what happens if you're in India? Well, they have two different character sets, 18 different official languages, and 5,000 unofficial languages. But what happens when you're in Colombia and the official language is Spanish, but the native Indian tribes have 60 different languages that they speak? Well, what happens when you're in Africa and you speak Swahili and there is no word processor that processes Swahili? Not just the first dialect of Swahili, but all four dialects of Swahili. Guess what? There is a word processor that does that now. It's called OpenOffice. And for the first time, Swahili people can actually use a word processor in their own language. It's kind of funny. I was down in Brazil and I was talking with the Microsoft product manager. He told me how proud he was that Microsoft supported 50 different languages. I said, Red Hat supports 51. And not only that, don't even talk to me about Microsoft Turkish. Because if you go to the country of Turkey and you say Microsoft Turkish to any computer person, they will burst into laughter. And they will tell you it's easier for the Turkish people to use Microsoft products in English than it is for them to use it in Turkish. With open source, you can make the business decision about whether or not you're going to have that software supported in your language. Because you can hire somebody to go through and change the strings that prompt you to the language you use. You can hire somebody to make sure the software does the job properly. Or you can make the business decision to live with it the way it is. But that's your decision to make. So the new model of software development is to pull down the basic software off the internet. And you can use it as it exists. You can use OpenOffice as it exists. You can use MySQL as it exists. You can use Postgres as it exists. You can use Gnuplot as it exists. You can use all these different open source software products as they exist. Or, if you need to have a change, you can make a business decision about whether you can change that software to meet your needs. Now, all of you out there who are programmers, you're saying, oh my God, I'm going to go into this. I'm going to be a service person. That's a bad word, service. You know, because service, that's the people down at the hamburger place flipping the hamburgers, or the people that sweep the streets, right? Now, there's nothing wrong with those occupations. Those are honorable working occupations that people make money. But it's just not what you want to do. I started off my life as an electrical engineer. And when I saw somebody electrocuted by 13,600 volts and 800 amps, I immediately went into software. 12 volts and a milliamp, you know, do it to me. But the other side of it was, I might have to be outside in the whirling hot sun, being beaten upon by the sun. Versus as a software person, I would almost always be in a nice, cool, air-conditioned office with the humidity control and everything else. So, that's why I went there. And people say, I don't want the service stuff. Too hard. But a lot of you are thinking about the service like this in Venezuela, which used to be an almost completely Microsoft country. And the people there can only make $850 a month installing prepackaged products. Because if they tried to charge more than that, the customer would say, oh, you're charging too much money. I can get a high school student to install that software. And they could. And then the person installing the software had no ability to say, no, no, I can do more than just install the software. Because they couldn't change it. So what happens with these students in Venezuela and graduating, they would move to England or Spain to get jobs. Because in England and Spain, not only did they install software, but they tailored the software to the customer's needs. And instead of being paid $850 a month, they were paying $3,000 a month, which allowed them to buy food and cars and take the opposite sex out on dates, which they're doing. Graduating university student is the most important thing. Don't think of service like a hamburger flipper. Think of service like a brain surgeon. A brain surgeon does not create a product. You didn't end up with a second brain when they get finished. It's a service. A highly trained, highly skilled, highly paid service. Think of a lawyer. A lawyer definitely creates no products. But you pay them, wait. It's a service. And they make a lot of money. How many of you see lawyers driving around in ratty cars? No. They make a lot of money. And you have to be that highly trained, highly skilled, highly knowledgeable service person. The person who can go into that company and say, I can save you $2 million a year by writing a piece of software to do this job. How much will you pay me for it? Now, if the business person is smart, they will say, well, that's worth at least $500,000 to me. That's a reasonable return, you know. So they'll pay you $500,000. You then write 12 lines of program code and disappear. But, in
It saves them that $2 million a year, and everybody's happy. They don't care if it only took you 2 days to write that 15 or 20 lines of code. That's not the issue. The issue is you save them $2 million a year. That's what a lawyer does. They don't even know. They only spend 10 minutes on your case. You know that, right? And they still charge you the full $300 an hour. Roebuck's in New Hampshire. The person writing that Roebuck, by the way, is Aaron Troen, one of the three people who started Red Hat Software. The company that made that robot is called Real World Interfaces. It's about 10 miles from my house. They use Linux as the operating system for their robots. Why? Because they find out that their customers can help them make Linux better to control the robots. New arms, new eyes, new little listening ears and stuff. What do they do with these robots? The U.S. Army uses a lot of them. The police and fire departments use a lot of them because they send these robots into dangerous situations. And if the robot goes into a burning building looking for people and finds one, then they can send the firemen into the building to try and rescue the person. If they send the robot down a dark alley and somebody shoots the robot, that's okay because it's only a robot. If the robot is going through Iraq and hits a minefield and he's blown up, that's okay because it's only a robot. And better, 10,000 robots be blown up than a single human being. In 1994 and 1995, supercomputer companies were going out of business. And we need supercomputers. We need the capability of doing these types of calculations. And Dr. Thomas Sterling and Dr. Donald Becker created the concept of using commodity off-the-shelf components to make a supercomputer, which we call Beowulf systems, made up of simple high-speed networking and common products. If you take a standard interface or relatively standard interface like Linux and combine that with a relatively uniform architecture like Intel or Power, or any of the others, you can actually create a binary standard which allows you to run the same applications from your supercomputers as you do on your notebook. And you can create thousands of nodes. In fact, of the top 500 supercomputers in the world, most of them run the Linux operating system. One of them uses Microsoft, but that's because Mr. Bill pays them to. And you can even tie together inexpensive PCs with highly sophisticated networking to create your own supercomputer. This brings up another concept, barrier to entry. It's interesting because with proprietary software, if you're going to create an embedded system product, for instance, you first have to negotiate with the company that's going to sell you their operating system as to how much you pay per copy. Or if you need to make a change to a proprietary product in order to make your solution work, you have to negotiate with the company that owns proprietary software. And this could be time consuming and expensive. With free software, you don't have to negotiate with anybody. With free software, your right to negotiate is given to you by the GPL. You don't have to tell anybody what you're going to do with the software. You don't have to ask anybody's permission to do it with the software. As long as you obey the GPL, you can do it. Or any other software license. It was funny, I was in Israel a few years back. It was my second or third trip to Israel. And I expected by this time there would be lots of open source companies. And I looked around and there was only one. And I said, where are all the other open source companies? And the one company got a smile on their face and said, they're waiting for the letter of authorization. I said, the what? And they said, you know, if there was Microsoft, you have to get the letter of authorization from Microsoft that said that you were the representative of Microsoft in the country. And then you would use that letter to go to everybody else and prove that you were the person he talks to because you had the letter of authorization. I said, but they're never going to get that. There's nobody who can give you a letter of authorization for open source software because the GPL already gives it to you. And the company said, we know. And I made this a point of my talk to the Israeli people, and the next year there were five different companies all doing free software in Israel. I went to India on the same trip. I looked around and said, India, I mean, you guys are alone to Unix and everything. Where are your Linux companies? They said, we're waiting for the letter of authorization. You don't have to wait for the letter of authorization. There's nothing which stops you from going ahead. So let's take a look at a company in Rio de Janeiro, 18 people. And what the company wanted to do was investigate the rainforest for new plastics, new medicines, new materials. The only trouble was the software typically used to do this came from a company in the United States. And it was
breathtakingly expensive.
There's two types of proprietary software. There's expensive proprietary software, and then there is
breathtakingly expensive software.
This was the latter. $500,000 per seat. And the worst part was it was only available in English. And believe it or not, the people in Brazil spoke Portuguese. I know you can relate to this. The only thing was they didn't know English, none of them. And so they said, please, company, could you please make this software available in English? And the company said, well, how many copies are you going to buy? And they said, we'll buy 9 copies. No, I'm sorry. For $4.5 million, it isn't worth it to us to make a Portuguese version. It isn't in our best business interest to do that. There's another phrase. Isn't that wonderful? Our best business interest. How many times have you heard that from your vendor? Our best business interest. What about your best business interest? What about what's best for your company? That's what you have to ask. And so, the little company in Rio de Janeiro went to an open source developer and they said, here's the specification for the software, here's the user manual, they gave us a free copy of it. Could you duplicate the functionality of this software using open source? And the guy says, sure. I'll use Postgres as a database. I use Hadoop to plot out the results. I use some pieces of extra open source software, some OpenGIS software. I use Apache to deliver the data, and I use Perl to tie all this together. And in 3 months of programming time, he had duplicated the portion of the software that they really needed for much less money than they would have paid, and profited in Portuguese. And so this company could now exist. And today they employ 18 people in Rio de Janeiro, plus the software developer from time to time. And when you go to their website, they say, we have jobs, but no English-speaking people need apply, because we are a Portuguese-speaking company. In St. Petersburg, there is a turbine test bed. Now, we have been producing steam turbines for about 200 years. That's about as long as Hans Christian Andersen was alive, yes. Or he wasn't alive for 2 years. And even as long as we've been producing these turbines, we still don't really know how they work. We know how the first stage works, when the steam first comes into the turbine. But then what you want to do is take the output of the steam and work it through other stages of the turbine to utilize all of the energy that's in the steam. And that's a very, very complex calculation. And And so what we do today, even today, is that we build the turbine, send them to the turbine test bed, and test them for the efficiency of the blades. Now, there are five of these turbine test beds in the world. Four of them use software from a large company that writes them for it. And they charge them for the software, and they change it when it has to be made. The fifth company, the fifth turbine test bed, uses open source software to do the same thing. Linux is the operating system that handles all the sensors and everything, stores the data in a MySQL database, uses GNU plot to plot out the results, and uses TickleTK to draw the diagrams and everything, but delivers the information using Apache to all his customers who are scattered throughout the world. His customers then take the results of his testing and create a PDF document that they paste into their reports. And they love his software. And if they need a simple change to the software, they send us an email, and he can typically make that change overnight. The other four companies, it may take them a month or 2 months to get the proprietary company to make that change. If they will make that change. And so the question you have to ask yourself is, who gets the better service? The other four companies use the proprietary software, or the customers of the man in St. Petersburg? They get the better service, and they pay him for it. In Helsinki in June of 1997, I saw my first kiosk was using Linux. I said to myself, oh my God, what a beautiful thing, Linux for kiosks and embedded systems. You don't have to pay a royalty on a per copy basis. And take a look at how good Linux is for this, because it's secure and it's stable. There's nothing worse getting off the airplane, going over to the kiosk to find out where the good restaurant is and seeing the blue screen of death. Or imagine going to an ATM machine and sticking your card in, and you punch in your secret number, and you punch in the fact that you want the money coming out, and boom, the whole thing collapses in front of you. No card, no money. But worse yet, you're not quite sure whether it actually took the money out before it crashed or not. Multitasking. You would be able to update your kiosk at the same time the customer's using it. Multi-architecture, you want to be able to choose the chip you're going to make when you make 100,000 or 200,000 kiosks. If you save $10 per chip, that means you may save $1 million in production. Royalty-free. And not only royalty-free, but you don't even have to tell anybody that you're going to use it. You don't have to negotiate with them. And then there's other embedded systems. That top one up there is a complete computer system on a 30-pin SIM. That's a United States quarter, 25 cent piece next to it. This one here, this is the top part of it, that's the bottom. That's an IBM gigabyte disk drive on it. This is a stronger arm chip. It's a complete server system, 32 megabytes of main memory, Ethernet, USB port, as I said, the 1 gigabyte disk. And that again is the United States quarter. A watch. Once you runs Linux, you can actually get a shell prompt. This little program says hello watch instead of hello world. And because you have the complete source code for all of the operating system, and because you have people all over the world changing Linux in so many different ways, for so many different purposes. How many of you have looked at Canonics, and how many different ways people have changed Canonics to meet all these different needs? And they can do it because they can do it. They didn't have to ask. So one of the things I recommend to people more particularly the Senate University professors in the room, buy something like this. This is a breadboard here. This sells for $35. All it has on it are a bunch of holes for wire mounting, and then a bunch of connectors. This is the entire CPU and computer system with Ethernet controller, CPU, memory, flash, everything else. Buy lots of these motherboards for university students and challenge them to develop a new Metasystem product as a project. Have them work together in teams if you want. And then, when they've written the software, created the hardware, encourage manufacturers to take these prototypes and create new designs for new products, which you can then manufacture and put even more people to work. Nobody ever has more time than a college student. They don't think so, but it's true. And you can get a lot out of them. But you don't have to stop with college students. 3 miles from my house, there lived a young man. When we first met him, he was 15. He'd been writing device drivers for Linux since the age of 12. He'd been programming since the age of 8. His father actually had hired him for a summer and paid him $40,000 to do programming and systems administration for his company. And today, at the ripe old age of 20, he is the senior systems administrator at a college in southwestern Massachusetts. How many of you have ever heard of the distribution FAT Linux, PHAT Linux? It was developed several years ago to install into the FAT file system of a Windows system so that you didn't have to repartition your disk. A friend of mine heard about this and called up the developer and said, "Would you like to do an interview on my radio show? You live only a few miles from where I do my broadcast." The voice in the front said, "I'd love to do that, but I'm afraid I can't because I don't have my driver's license yet. I'm 14 years old." And my friend says, "Well, what about the other person that helped you with this project?" "Oh, he's 14 also." We never met each other face to face. We've only worked over the internet. And my friend on the radio station called off the person, the kid's parents, and said, "I've got good news and bad news for you. The good news is you'll never have to worry about which college your student's going to go to. Any college will accept them. The second thing is, the bad news is you have to hire a lawyer to help him manage all of his money that people are paying him for this distribution." They have no idea he had done it. At the Atlanta Linux Symposium in Atlanta, Georgia, the Debian group wanted to have a stand. But they had miscalculated, and they thought the trade show was going to open a day later than it was. They had shipped all of their equipment and all of their network supplies to Atlanta. But they had nobody to put it together. And one person on the mailing list said, "I'll do it. I'll put it together for you. I live in Atlanta. You tell me how you want to have it set up. I'll arrange it." And they got there, and everything was set up perfectly. All the networking was done. Everything was set to go. And the person who did it was 13 years old. It had occurred to them to ask him, "How old are you?" Because when you're on the internet, nobody knows that you're a dog.
Yeah.
And finally, I was at a trade show. I was walking down the aisle, and I heard these voices arguing. Two voices that were kind of deep, male voices, and this highly pitched voice. As I came around the corner, I found that there were two Hewlett-Packard engineers arguing about the proper way of decomposing an application to run it available. And the person they were arguing with was an 11-year-old boy. That's him. The interesting part was, the 11-year-old was right. With open source software, There are no blocks to where you want to go. There's no wall for you to run up against. There's no box which is black. That's the good news. The bad news is you can't charge a proprietary amount of money. You can't charge, you can't hide behind the fact that you are keeping some intellectual property away from somebody else. You are going to be in direct competition with everybody else on the face of the earth for providing that service and that software. That's the bad news. That means that you're going to have to be the best. You're going to have to keep up every day with exactly what's going on, with what software is out there, how to change it. You're going to have to know the customer's business so you can help them out in making that software meet their needs. But if you can do that, you will be the brain surgeon of software. Universities, a lot of times, will use Microsoft in teaching their courses. And they'll say they do that because they want their students to have a job when they come out, because everybody uses Microsoft. I said, let me get this straight. You're teaching engineers how to build bridges and tall buildings. You're teaching biologists how to change genes and make new medicines. You're teaching people to be the leaders of your country. And they're smart enough to do that, but they're too stupid to learn how to use Microsoft Office in less than a day. They can't use a book called Microsoft Office for Dummies and figure out how to use it. And in fact, some of them were saying this yesterday. They're either too stupid or they're too smart. You don't have a middle road. I think that the courses that should be taught are comparative word processor usage, comparative spreadsheet usage. Show them several different spreadsheets and then let them make the decision about which one is the best one for their use. People talk about free software and collaboration. Yet how many universities actually today teach people how to collaborate? Very few. They're too concerned with making sure that each student is being able to be tested to make sure that they know what they're supposed to know. It's hard to teach collaboration. It's hard to test collaboration. There's a piece of software developed out of Brazil called Sangu. It is a complete university administrative system. It's developed using free software, and the entire system is GPL. You can go to the site and pull it down and use it for free. The first version of Sangu, naturally, used Portuguese. But after a few universities had used it, some of the South American countries that speak Spanish said, could we use it too? And then, almost instantly, there was a version of Portuguese and a version of Spanish. And the last time I knew, there was a Japanese programmer living in Germany who was creating the English version. That should be interesting. But the point of this is not Sangu itself. The point of this is two other universities I know of. The University of Utah also wants to have an administration system. They are looking at using proprietary software to create it. They estimate that it's going to cost them $16 million to create this system. Now, what does Sangu do? I mean, it's free software. Right? Well, first of all, it keeps track of all the entrance exams of every student who wants to come into the university. It then schedules every student's classes. It schedules the classroom usage. It schedules the professor's time. It keeps track of all the records of all the students. It checks their prerequisites for taking other courses. It checks their library books out of the library, checks them back in. Keep track of the library fines, generates reports for the government so that the universities can get new student grants and loans. It does all of the administrative work of the university. And any student can find out what their status is by going to any web browser
logging in with their login name and password, and they find out exactly where they stand. This is what the University of Utah wants. They could have it for free and then just tailor it to what they need exactly. But that's not the worst case. There's a university in Australia who's been trying to use PeopleSoft. For the last 7 years, they've been trying to use PeopleSoft to create an administrative system for the university. They have spent 22 million Australian dollars in 7 years, and it still does not work. And PeopleSoft, PeopleSoft tells them they have to spend another 7 million Australian dollars for a generic version of the PeopleSoft software, not even something tailored to their needs. I read about this in a magazine while I was flying over the Atlantic, and I wrote a letter to the magazine and I said, I have a solution. The $7 million you're going to pay to PeopleSoft, take Sangu, hire 2 Brazilian programmers at only $1 million Australian dollars per year. Have them work for 2 years, so that's $4 million Australian dollars. And I guarantee you, you'll have a better system. I'll take the other $3 million Australian dollars minus me. I didn't give any answer back. So what do we need to teach students in the future? How to do distributed development. How to license software in the various open source licenses and what they need. What changes can they do? How to develop formal standards and then implement to those standards. How to motivate software developers to do the things that you need to have done. And how to locate and engage the community of users and developers to help you do the things which are to their best benefit. How to size projects and write contracts. This is almost a forgotten art. Many years ago, there was a kind of rule of thumb that said, how long would it take a software person to develop a piece of software? You estimated the lines of code, you divided by the number of years the person had been writing code, and then you multiplied by the size of their belt, and that gave you how many days. And of course, it was a fictitious way of doing it, but we've lost the ability of accurately estimating how big the job is. We need to get them back again. And how to determine that a project exists, define what it is, and sell the project to the end customer. This is where you stop being programmers and you start being software entrepreneurs. Now, you're going to be told lots of things, typically by a company in Redmond, Washington, about free software. You're going to be told that the total cost of ownership of Linux is not any better than the total cost of ownership of Windows. Who cares? I don't. It means absolutely nothing. Nothing at all. Because it's not the total cost of the software that makes the difference. It's the total value of the software that makes a difference. Because if the software doesn't do anything, the software, oops, that was bad. Might be reading this again. If the software doesn't do anything, then the software has no value. And if the software has no value, and you subtract total cost of ownership, you actually end up with a negative value for the software. If, on the other hand, the software does exactly what you need, then the software is infinitely valuable. It doesn't make any difference how much it costs.
picked a small company in Rio de Janeiro. If they had to use proprietary software that didn't prompt in Portuguese, they could not exist. And so no matter how much money they had to pay for that software, it still would not have done them any good. The value of that proprietary software was zero, and the total cost of ownership was huge, as opposed to open source, where the total cost was much less, but the value to them was in effect infinite. That's what we should be concentrating on, the value of the software. You're going to be told that Linux doesn't scale. That's obviously untrue. It scales as well as any other operating system does in a tightly coupled SMP environment, or at least as good as any modern bus structure would use in a normal situation. How many people have worked with systems that have over 14 processors on one bus? Okay, one out of all of you. Okay? They're relatively few. On the other hand, if you take a look at the world's largest supercomputer, 10,240 processors all working together in a single system image in Ames, NASA, in California. That runs Linux. 10,240 processors. You're going to be told that Linux is hard to use. In reality, it's just different. In Thailand, the government had a project where they were going to give inexpensive computers to people who had never seen computers before. And to do that, they put Linux on it. Microsoft heard about this and said, oh, this is going to create software piracy, because people will take off Linux and put on Windows, because that's what they really want. And there was a study done on this. And come to find out, about 25% of the people did take off Linux and put on Windows. Microsoft was right. On the other hand, 75% of them left Linux on, even though they could have pirated Windows and put it on. And when they asked them about it, they said, you know, we think it's easier to use the Thailand version of Linux than it is to use Microsoft. So 75% of them left Linux on their notebooks because they'd never seen a computer system before. They'd never used one. It was equally difficult to use. The other interesting part about this is in a normal environment in Thailand, over 60% of the systems run pirated software. So actually, they had a lower percent of piracy for these systems than they did Microsoft, please. KDE did a study. And again, in their study, they found that for non-computer users, it was easier to use KDE than it was to use Microsoft Windows. And finally, in the United States, there's a company called Ball Music. They make guitar strings. They make guitar strings for some of the best guitars in the world. It's a family-owned business. And they were rated by the Business Software Alliance. And they found out that 8% of the systems that Ball Music had unlicensed software on them. 8%. That's almost 10%. That's outrageous. That many systems should have unlicensed software. On the other hand, 92% of this software was perfectly licensed. I used to teach at a university. 92 is an A. You're doing good. And particularly for a company whose business was not software. Their business was making guitar strings. Why did they have unlicensed software? Same way a lot of us do. They go in, they get a new machine, they put it on their engineer's desk. As the machine becomes older, they give it to the secretaries and so forth. They forgot to remove the software that was licensed for the engineer. But this did not help them with the BSA. The BSA reported this to newspapers, The BSA fined them $40,000. The BSA took them to court. The BSA made an example of ball music.
Oh, yes, they did. They made a wonderful example of ball music.
Because Sterling Ball, the president of the company, said, "That's it. All proprietary software is out of my company. All of it." And in less than 3-year period of time, they completely switched over to open source software. They became a spokesperson for the software open source industry. He said, "I don't understand why people say it's so hard. None of my people complained. They're all using OpenOffice. We're using it fine. No problems. I don't know why people are having problems with Linux. None of my systems administrators are complaining." He says, "We have it. There's no problem." BSA did a great job. You're going to be told that a company in Redmond, Washington's code is open. We're open. We have shared source. We share our source code with you. We have a shared source. This shows that Bill Gates flunked out of Harvard. Because if he stayed in, he would have found out that there's over 200 countries in the world. So let's say I'm a university here in Denmark, and I'm doing research with the university in China. And I'm required to make some changes to the Microsoft products. I can't do that. Because China is one of those countries that Microsoft does not share the source code with. Let's say I'm here in Denmark and decide to share my source code with the University of Cuba. Can't do that. Not only can does Microsoft not share the source code with Cuba, they can't share the source code with Cuba. Why not? Because Cuba has been under embargo from the United States for the last 40 years. They are legally not allowed to use computers from the United States or software from the United States. They do, of course. They use pirated copies of Microsoft and they get their computers from Chile. But Fidel Castro has now said Linux is the future because everybody in the world owns Linux. Not just the United States. What about universities? Let's say I'm doing research at a university and I want to share my source code and the results of my research with some company someplace. I might not be able to do that because the shared source program says I can look at the source code, but I can't really change it. I have to give the code back to Microsoft, and Microsoft has to incorporate those changes into their operating system before I can share it with somebody. In 1992, Digital Equipment Corporation made the changes to Windows NT to allow it to be a true 64-bit system. Why do we do that? Because we have Windows NT on the Alpha processor, which has 64-bit address space. What would this have done for our customers? It would have allowed them to access more than 4 billion bytes of data at the same time. How much data could they have accessed? They could have accessed 128 bytes of data for every square millimeter of the surface of the Earth, including all the oceans. This would have been a big plus for the Alpha processor, but Microsoft refused to change it because they said it wasn't in their best business interest to put them into Windows NT. And this is why Longhorn, which is going to be due out in the year 2006, 2007, 2008, 2009, will be the first Microsoft operating system to support the 64-bit address space. We also offered Microsoft clustering software. Because we have some of the best clustering software in the world. Instead, Microsoft implemented their own called Wolfpack. It was the only time I ever saw two computers much slower than one. could be made to everybody is if the vendor of that software allows it. And will you share your source code with all your competitors? Do you think that Microsoft would share the source code of Microsoft SQL with Larry Ellison? I think they should. Larry knows something about databases. I think that he's a good partner of theirs, right? But he sells lots of Microsoft systems by putting Oracle on top of it. I think that Microsoft should share the source code. It would do them good. Larry might be able to give them a couple of fixes to make them work a little bit better. Do you think that they would share the source code with Scott McNeely of Sun Microsystems? They should. Didn't they make a big agreement recently about how they're going to work together and all this other stuff? When I saw that agreement, I said, Scott. You know, you're walking into the tiger's den. There's never been anybody who's made an agreement with Microsoft that hasn't regretted it, maybe. And a lot of people think I'm picking on Microsoft, but this is not just a Microsoft problem. It's a problem of closed source proprietary software. You can be told that innovation comes from the proprietary companies. That innovation has to be protected through intellectual property rights, through software patents. Well, I invite you to go out and take a look at the over 90,000 projects that are out at SourceForge, with over 1 million people who are innovating on it. And this is without the entire industry being in the open source marketplace. This is without China being fully on board with all their students being fully connected to the internet, without India being fully connected. What's SourceForge going to look like when all those people are working together? Software patents came about at a different time, when computers cost millions of dollars a piece, and software programmers were counted in the thousands instead of in the millions. It came about at a time where people had to make an investment. But ironically, software patents did not exist back in those days. They didn't exist back in the days of Grace Mary Hopper or Maurice Wilkes or Eckert Brooklyn Beniac. They didn't exist at the time of Dennis Ritchie and Ken Thompson or Benny Unix. They came much later. And today we have companies trying to patent 10,000 software patents at a time. Let me give you an image of what that's like. I am Michelangelo. I am painting the Sistine Chapel, lying on my back, painting. 20 years has gone past, painting. In comes my arch enemy, Leonardo da Vinci. Oh, Michelangelo, beautiful painting you have. But you have to start all over again because last week I patented that brushstroke. Or, Beethoven has just finished the Beethoven 9th Symphony. Ode to Joy, one of the most beautiful pieces of music ever written. Beethoven has been conducting the orchestra. He finishes in triumph. But he can't hear anything because he's deaf. He doesn't hear the audience behind him, wildly applauding and standing on their feet. He thinks he's a failure. And he looks over, and his arch enemy, Handel, is coming in off the wings. Beautiful sonata, Beethoven. He signs with the wings of his death. Beautiful sonata. But you have to start all over again, because last week I patented the triplet. With 10,000 software patents being applied for, even if they don't get them, how can a programmer sit there and write lines of code without worrying about whether or not they're going to violate one of those software patents? In the United States, if you look at the ruling of software patents at the law, it says for the propagation of science and culture, we give this protection to intellectual property. And the question you have to ask yourself, modern age, which is going to give society as a whole the better innovation? Some companies working in the closet secretly and doing the innovation, or the entire community working together doing the innovation? I think it's the entire community. And that is why software patents are not only bad, but they're evil. If I had a choice between Satan, George Bush, and software patents, I would definitely take Satan. And so people say to me, Mad Dog, okay, how do I convince my customer to use free and open source software? And if they don't know, if they're afraid, then start off with places that you know is going to save them money, and it's going to be simple, and it's going to work. Set up a nice firewall system for them. Set up a nice file and print server system for them. You know, set up a nice web-based system, a LAMP system for them. Take some free software that works on top of Microsoft and give it to them. Firefox, for instance. Show them the free software is high quality, highly stable, and solves their problems. And then you can go on to supply them with the rest of the software for their business needs. Many years ago, I had a friend of mine named Jonathan Eunice. He was an analyst for enterprise systems. And I talked to him about Linux, and he said, oh, that's a toy. It doesn't solve anybody's needs. 5 years later, I met up with him again and said, Jonathan, what do you think about Linux now? He goes, it's getting pretty good. He says, I've looked at it, and I've got running on my server at home. He says, yeah. He says, it's getting there. 2 years later, I said, Jonathan, what do you think about Linux? At this point, it was about a year ago, we were at a large conference for enterprise systems. He was sitting up on the stage when I asked the question. I put him on the spot. I said, Jonathan, what do you think about Linux? He said, I would recommend it to all my customers except for the very largest and most critical database applications. Now, you have to understand the way Jonathan works. He will take a piece of software, give it to some customers, and let them use it for a year, and they get feedback from them before he will give a recommendation. And at this point, he was using and looking at Linux systems that are running 2.4 kernel, not 2.6 kernel. And when I reminded him of this, he then, in his mind, looked at the features of the 2.6 kernel and said, I will now remove the last qualification. I will now recommend it to all my customers. And examples of this, many of you are familiar with these. Munich, switching over 14,000 desktops. Not because it was the lowest total cost of ownership. It's because Munich knows that the old town and the new town hall is 700 years old. The oldest software company on the face of the earth is 40 years old. And there's this dichotomy. The fact that they need to have control over their email system. They need to have control over the computers that they're writing their government on. They can't be influenced by a software company in the United States who happens to be bought by somebody else or who happens to go out of business. And people say to me, Mad Dog, that's why I buy my software from a large company like Microsoft. And I say, oh, from a large company like Wang, a large company like Data General, a large company like Prime, if you don't remember these companies, they were large, okay? A large company like Digital Equipment Corporation, a large company like Compaq. And even though it's true that Digital was bought by Compaq and Compaq was bought by Hewlett-Packard, As you combine these companies, product lines disappear, products disappear, and you as a customer are forced to make a decision about whether you go with a new product or whether you don't. If you have a source code, if it was open source, you could make the business decision about whether you went with a new product or whether you maintain the old one until a time that you can make the transition more gracefully. China has made the Linux operating system the operating system of choice. And when they were threatened by Microsoft that said, we're going to send them to BSA, China said, go ahead. We already have a word processing package and an operating system that we sell in a box for one-tenth of the price of yours. And oh, by the way, once you buy that box one time, you can apply it on as many systems as you want. Brazil has blended government with private industry and the Linux community through all sorts of interesting projects. And they've kept careful track of how much money they save, how well the project works using open source. And they can show time and time and time again that open source delivers a better product at lower cost. Here's some interesting opportunities when you can use open source that's based on open standards. Because it's based on standards, you can go in and create hardware accelerators for a lot of things the software would normally do. You can create controller boards which will implement those standards. And you don't have to change the software that uses them, it's just the software works faster. You can create in-service and integration, because you can not only develop the glue code that goes between the software products, you can change the software products on either side of the glue code in better integration. And you can create what we call business amplifiers. It's not necessarily that you can't do this with proprietary software, but you can do it easier with open source software to allow your customer to create better products for their end users, less expensive and faster innovation. With that, I'd like to thank Linux International, who sponsors my abilities to come around and give talks like this. IBM put this really cool laptop that they goes all over the world, takes a beating, keeps ticking. Linux Forum for inviting me to pay my travel expenses. But most of all, I'd like to thank the Linux and open source community itself for all the things that it's done, all the projects that I've seen as you go around the world that simply could not be done with proprietary software. Africa needs clean water. They had a project that was providing clean water to 8,000 families. They wanted to provide clean water to another 7,000 families, but they did not do it. Why? Because the accountant was keeping track of how much this project was costing. The accountant was getting 2 or 3 pennies each month from the 8,000 families to help pay for the project, could not keep track of it all. He said, if I just had a little computer system with a simple accounting package, we could provide the support to the other 7,000 families. And so a nonprofit organization called Kite in Boston took a donated computer, open source software, created a simple accounting package, gave them the computer system, and maintained it over the internet. And now Oracle Project supplies clean water to another 15,000 families. In India, they have a computer called SimCuter. I talked to you about India before and its language problems. I didn't mention that 15-20% of all Indians are illiterate. They can't read or write in any language. And yet, by utilizing icons, you can even allow illiterate people allows them to do that. The question you have to ask yourself is, what proprietary for-profit company would see a marketplace providing computers for illiterate people? And the answer is, very few. And so the open source community has been able to allow these people to do useful things with these computers. The Royal Navy and Air Rescue Force of Great Britain used to send helicopters, or still do, send helicopters over the North Atlantic looking for people who crashed. They used a proprietary system based on land to supply them with information. By using open source, they were able to move the application onto a laptop and take it with them in the helicopter, and therefore cut down the rescue time almost in half. So for all people who have been rescued in the North Atlantic, I thank the open source community. The Genome Research Project keeps huge amounts of data in a MySQL database. If you use a proprietary database and you want to share your information with another university, you have to unload the data from the database, put it onto a transport medium, send it to the other university. They have to buy the same database engine you have. They have to load the data back in, and then they can use it. With MySQL, you say, here's an image of the disk. Go to it. Oh, by the way, here's not only the database, here's the operating system, all the data, all the programs on that image. Use it. You don't have to worry about the licensing of the software. In Rio de Janeiro, in Sao Paulo, Brazil, I saw my first payroll system, 160 processors working together. And one of the uses they had of it was looking at a mammogram, a picture of a woman's breast that had cancer. It took a Spark System 20 over 24 hours to process the mammogram, one mammogram. And so the woman came to the hospital to have the mammogram taken. When told it would take 24 hours for the results to come back, would go back up to her village. And if the results were bad, sometimes it was hard to get her to come back for more tests or to have the operation. Now the hospital FTPs the mammogram to the university, and 10 minutes later they have back the same results. And while the woman is still filling out the insurance papers, the doctor can come up and say, congratulations, you don't have cancer, or I'm sorry, we have to do more tests, or I'm really sorry, you haven't, we should schedule an operation. And then you get the counseling right there at that time. And so for every woman's life who's ever been saved, I thank you. At the University of the South Pacific in Fiji, there are students who are trained to do systems administration all through the island countries we've all heard of, Tahiti, Solomon Islands. They needed to teach the students how a real operating system worked. So one day I showed up with a CD of Linux software for them. As I gave them this software, it was the closest to feeling like God I ever felt. Because they were connected to the internet by one 1200 bit per second modem. And for them to pull down source code for even the kernel would have taken them days. Just about that time there would be a hurricane coming through, the line would drop, they'd have to start over again. But I said to them, here's all the source code for the operating system, all the source code for the compilers, all the source code for the networking, all the source code for relational database systems, all the source code for all these things. Here it is. As a product manager of Digital Unix, I knew that I was giving them all of the neighborhood of $2.5 billion of intellectual property here. That's why I felt like God. And so for all those students who have learned how to use computer systems, I thank you. I mentioned Cuba, 40 years in embargo. They have 1,600 doctors on the island of Cuba, and the medical books are falling apart. They needed some way of distributing new medical information to them. They use that time, 486 computers running Linux to create the network for the doctors to give information. And for all the people that those doctors have helped, I thank you. And finally, in Purple Lab outside of Chicago, they're looking for the smallest particle on the face of the Earth. If you're not familiar with how they do that, there's a large accelerator, a mile and a quarter in diameter, that speeds the particles up until they reach close to the speed of light. And then at the very last moment, they bend the particles around and the particles collide. At that moment, it is the hottest place in the entire universe. And the particles break down to create the tiniest particles, which are known as quarks. Theoretically, there were 6 quarks, and they only found 5. In the last year, Fermi Lab found the 6th quark. But the problem was that they had only seen 12 of these quarks in the entire year that they run their accelerator. And each quark was only visible for 10 to the minus 24th seconds. Now, to give you an idea of how small a time that is, if you're traveling at the speed of light, in 10 to the minus 24th seconds, you can go from the center of a proton to the edge of a proton. And so, the particles collide, beat down, and that was quark! Boom, it's gone. What does it look like? I don't know. Kind of look like Mickey Mouse, right? Oh, Walt Disney, don't say that. And they actually had a little drawing up there of what we think a quark looks like, you know. So they decided that what they would do is they would boost the power of the ring 200 times, which meant that they had to dig up the entire ring at a 1 1/4 mile diameter. They had to make the magnets, which were already massive, 200 times more powerful. And then somebody said, well, this is going to generate 200 times more data, and therefore we're going to have 200 times more computing power. Uh-oh. We don't have the budget for that. And so they started looking at Beowulf systems. And by using commodity-based computers, and by dividing the problem up, they were able to sift through all the data generated and still only have to store a terabyte of data a day. And so, at Fermi Lab this year, there are 4,096 processors working together to filter through that data. So we will finally be able to figure out what the smallest particle in the universe looks like. And I'm just hoping it isn't George Bush. With that, I thank you very much. I'll try and answer any questions if you have them. Thank you. Tomorrow morning, just look in the mirror. Thank you.